So welcome everybody. Going to start. Let's do some CloudStack automation talking today. So before we start, is everybody familiar with CloudStack already, with the Apache CloudStack project? Do we recognize some faces? Yes. So Apache CloudStack is the infrastructure as a service offering. That means that you can build your own cloud. It can be a private cloud. It can be a public cloud if you want, hybrid, all possibilities. So CloudStack is software to orchestrate the components in your infrastructure. And it provides an API so you can talk to it and you can automate stuff. So that's what we're going to do. But before we dive into stuff like that, let me first introduce myself. So my name is Remy Bergsma. I am from the Netherlands. I work for a company, Schuberg Philis. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that. I'm an engineer that really loves building and managing infrastructures if they are based on open source technologies, because that way you can usually have very much influence in what stuff is going on, fix what's broken, and then make awesome stuff. So I'd like to automate what can be automated, because it usually makes stuff more more stable, makes it rock solid, and then also saves time. And this time you can use to spend new tools and techniques. And that makes stuff even better. So that's a win-win situation. So that's very nice. So Schuberg Philis is known for its 100% uptime thing. And we do functional uptime. And we were founded in 2001. And this was really, really our unique selling point back then. So we did the functional uptime, so all the way through the stack. So the infrastructure all the way up to the applications. We said, you know, it doesn't matter who wrote the software, it doesn't matter how hard it is, how bad it is, we just do it all. We said, we promise it will work 100% of the time. So that was very interesting at the time. We still do that, but we now feel it's a commodity to us. So everything we do should be 100%, because otherwise it makes no sense, right? Why should we be doing it? We're doing mission-critical stuff, so we really like to work with big companies like banks, infrastructures, also insurance company, energy trading, stuff like that. So if it breaks, it really hurts. So that keeps us sharp, it makes us exciting. And, you know, we got a lot of those, because everybody is now doing 100% functional uptime thing, so that's not our unique selling point anymore. But that's a good thing, because for the industry, this is what you really want. You know, you want people to think this is really, this should be 100% okay. But we also realized that, and this was 2012, that we needed to reinvent the company because of this thing going on. I mean, cloud was there, the 100% uptime wasn't enough anymore, so we had to reinvent ourselves to make a certain future for ourselves. So we invited everybody, all customers, all engineers, all other people that were working there, partners, everybody to join in and organize a summit. We were talking about it. How can we change that we're doing? So two things happened. One is that we really wanted to embrace open source technologies. We were using open source already, but we said, you know, we should open up. Let's just share everything we have. Let's not be afraid of intellectual property or stuff like that, because what we add is not our software or code or something like that. What we add is our smart people integrating stuff, making awesome and not only software. So we can just open up. And that was another thing. Our customer said, you know, this is cool what you're doing, but it takes too long and it's too expensive. So we want this light version of Schuberg Philis. And we didn't want to do that, because we only wanted to do it 100% okay, and not just 99%. So then we said, if we want to do this stuff 100%, then we need to automate the hell out of it. We should make it faster and cheaper, and then we can still do this stuff. So then we gave ourselves an assignment. We wanted to build a new environment that we could steer with an API, so we could automate it. And we wanted to grow organically, because we wanted to add more customers and go faster. What we also wanted to do is integrate with the existing environments that were there. You always have legacy. We have dedicated environment for dedicated customers. So every tenant, every customer has its own separated environment. So now we are merging those, maybe in a new environment, but we still had to integrate. We had to talk to them, to connect them. Security was also very important. We had a very nice security in place. It was very cool, but we wanted it to be more secure even, just to raise the bar for ourselves. Even more important, we like challenge ourselves. We said, you know what, we're not going to use anything that we ever used before. Let's go, let's have a look, let's see what else is out there. Let's have a look what open source companies are there, what startups are there, let's work with them, let's just make more awesome. So then you first have to let go of some of the things. We were a VMware shop, we used NetApp and all kind of traditional stuff. And then we said, no, we're not gonna do that anymore. Because it would have been too easy to go for VMware director, blah, 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 something like that. And then we started to work with all these companies. And CloudSec is also there. So we are also working, we tried to look at OpenStack, we looked at CloudSec, we looked at other opportunities, and then we chose CloudSec because it was really easy to get it going. We had VMs running very fast. There was a nice community. There was a nice energy, and we could co-create with these guys. We could just write all kind of cool stuff. There was an open environment, and we could go from there. We had influence on what was happening. The same was also happening with this company called Nicira. It's now being a part of VMware. It's called NSX these days. But back in the time, this was really new. Nobody in Europe was using software-defined networking back then. So we were the first to choose it and to use it in production. And what it does is it gets rid of everything that you need to manually configure on switches. So no more Ciscos with VLANs and stuff like that. We just automated the hell out of it. We had network separation by using L switches. Not going to dive in that technique, but it was really awesome. And we could also co-create with these guys. So there were more of these companies that we worked. Nexenta is another interesting one. Nexenta is a storage company that had this idea of a storage box that you can buy your own commodity hardware and then add their software on top of it. It was based on BSD stuff, and it was using ZFS, so it was very promising, very fast, a lot of IOPS. So interesting and cool stuff. Something that we need to remember, and we try to remember ourselves all the time, it needs to be 100%. It needs to be perfectly right. So, and this was a solid base. It was a commodity now, these days. So, but still, it had to be perfect. So we came up with this high-level design. Fairly simple idea. We had this concept in CloudSec of a zone, which is a place to run your VMs. And we wanted to split it over two data centers. Because we thought we did that in the past for physical environments as well. And we want redundancy within the zone. This is one way of doing it. You could also build different zones. That's what we are working on later on. And what we did was, per data center, have one rack of equipment that's doing services through a 4D zone. So you had the core network, on and off ramping, stuff like that, and also the NSX stuff. NSX is Nicira, so the software-defined networking. Storage for templates, stuff like that would go in one rack. And then we would scale. This is a pod in CloudSec. We would have many of those. So we would add racks with compute, and that was the way to add more capacity. We did that across two data centers. So it would end up in one virtual way of accessing the resources in CloudSec. Then we started. Yeah, can you? I'll go back one. Let's see this button.
So how far are your two data centers?
Both data centers are in Amsterdam, so they're like 10 miles across from each other, 20 miles, something like that. You could also use larger distances from over there. But there's also a way of creating multiple zones in CloudSec. And that's actually what you should maybe be doing.
Concerning, let's say you have data center called Conlon. It's really far away. I mean, how do you ensure that you have a fiber? And
Yeah, so we can talk about this in a moment. This is one way to say, well, we have a zone. You should have multiple zones if you want multiple, if you want redundancy across that. Because the application stack should be able to run in different areas, and then be able to provide redundancy even if you lose this whole zone. That's the idea. So we wanted to build multiple of those solutions. We're going to have a beer. I'm going to explain you why this is a good idea. So we started to do production. So we added all kind of customers. So the first and easiest things to do were test environments, developments, and stuff like that. So we very quickly grew to like 1,000, maybe 1,500 VMs, like that. So it's pretty awesome. Stuff started to run. But then, you know, we did hit some trouble. And this trouble, that was mainly you had some integrating issues. This is some time ago, right? We were pretty early in the cloud days. So we had integration issues, which we could solve. So the CloudSec issues, we sent pull requests, we fixed stuff. But there was one big issue that we really couldn't fix ourselves, and that was a problem with our storage. And because of the storage not functioning 100%, we had all kind of other trouble as well. So this pretty much failed because it didn't deliver the 100%. And well, this is another subject for over a beer if you want to know the details. But the thing is, we couldn't really co-create with these guys. And especially the clustered thing, the Nexenta Store HA, was pretty unreliable. It was a very good idea on paper, but in practice it was not good enough. So the thing was that we had many outages. I can remember many weekends that we had to work, and people would call and would say, oh, no, not again. So then the decision was made, you know, this is jeopardizing our cloud project. This is not okay, so we need to get rid of it. We just need to replace it. And that alone may sound easy. Of course, it has financial consequences, but there's also a lot of work involved. So then we said, okay, we don't want to do it again. And we had very good relationship with NetApp, but we wanted to change stuff. But then in the end, we said, you know, let's try to, if we can co-create with these guys and see if we can come up with something that really makes sense. So we made a building block for our pods that I just showed you. And they were really willing to help us, and we had a nice deal there. So we said, okay, you know, we're gonna do that. Because in the end, let's be honest, all we need is just a stable box that provides NFS, because that's what we use in CloudSec. Fairly easy, nothing special. So this is what we were doing. We had these Nexenta boxes here, Nexenta pods, two of them, two data centers. And then we said, you know, before we can do anything, we're going to build new stuff with NetApp, and we do twice as much as that we have, because then we can do new deployments on this directly, so we don't have to worry about migrations anymore. And we're going to migrate this stuff to the other pods. So that's an awful lot of work, because we had over 1,000 of those VMs running there, so we needed to pull them to the other side. And that's where we need automation, of course, because we're not going to do that all manually. And that's the interesting thing there where we meet in CloudSec. Everything has an API in CloudSec, so you can just talk to it and automate the hell out of it. But before we could do that, the first item to solve was to make sure we had an overview, because we had the clusters and everything, and VMs were running, and you could spin it up. It was all very easy. But then, you know, you need to know what's running where and how to migrate it to another site. We had different customers with different requirements, so some we could do in the weekend, some we had to do at night, some wanted to do it during the day. So we had to come up with something to make selections. And that's the first thing out of the toolbox, a script called list virtual machines. And it does exactly what it says. It just lists stuff. So I'm not going to go through all this because I have some examples, but there are many options you could use to select stuff. So running on a different pod or a cluster or whatever, you could make all kinds of selections. Let's do an example. If I say list virtual machines and only want to see stuff in my own domain, and I got a list over here. So I have a VM called Tiny, a VM called Remy, and then this VPC router going on. When you see the details, it has a nice summary, stuff like that. You could also use filters. You could say, you know, I want to filter on keywords. So here I provide, I want to only see the tiny one. That it list space just one. There's an option to only list routers. So say, you know, I want to list only my routers. So this, just one. And this way you can have all kind of selections. And of course, I'm limiting now by a domain, which is nice, could be a tenant. But you can also limit by cluster. So you can say, you know, this cluster is running on Nexenta. We want to get rid of it. So what's running there? I need to move it away. And then you could use a second one, because you can use both. You can say, on this cluster of Nexenta, you could only use this domain. That's how we could make selections. And because we had two data centers, we didn't want to do everything at the same time. We just wanted to do data center by data center, because then we could have two redundancy. So since this is just a script which you run in the shell, you can use bash magic. Nothing new here. So you can just use grep and cut and all kind of stuff like that, and then end up with just a list of instances. So VMs in CloudSec have these instances names. This is unique. So this is a certain VM that you could then use. Why this is a good idea and why this is handy, I'll come to that later, because I'll show you how to automate this stuff. The most important thing is that with this thing, we had everything we need to be able to make the selections. And if there's something missing, we can easily add to this listing overview thing. So we know what lives where and how we can make all kinds of selections. But now, how to migrate the stuff from one cluster to another? Should be easy, right? So then we thought, you know, let's try it. And then we figured out that the API couldn't do it. We couldn't migrate the stuff. And I thought first it was a UI problem. So I went to the API and said, you know, I'm going to use CloudMonkey and this is going to work. I'm going to do it like this. And then it said, no, you can do it. And why couldn't we do it? Because we had this concept of having a VM with a data disk. So you had one disk which is running the operating system and another disk that's using for the data. So if this VM would die, we'd just throw it away, we spin up a new one, and then connect the disk, and everybody would be happy again. So that seemed like a very flexible and good idea. But CloudSec couldn't handle it, because you cannot migrate it like this. It wants you to detach the disks first, and then reattach them. But that brings in problems, because you never know if you end up with the same, for example, if you're using Windows, if you get the same drive letter again. So that we really didn't want to do. This migration should be transparent for our end users. So magic was needed to get this stuff working, because, I don't know, we didn't want to do the detach of the disks. So we came up with a solution, and this is the solution. If you look at a VM, which is represented here by the green box, then you have this root disk, which is the operating system. Anyway, if the data disk, you can have multiple of those. So this is how it looks like. So if this migration doesn't work using the VM, you can migrate the disks. And that's what we did. So what we do is shut down this VM, migrate this disk, and start it there again. And that perfectly works fine. So then you might wonder, if you're shutting the VM, you don't have the 100% anymore, right? Because I told you about the 100%. So. But since we are doing it across multiple data centers and multiple zones, we had multiple application stacks running. So we could just shut down one and still keep running, and then bringing it online again on the new storage and do the other side, and then have 100% uptime still without ever by migrating everything like this. So if you need to do this migration, so this were 1,000 VMs already, so if I need to double this, and maybe even more, it doesn't really feel like something you want to do manually. So of course we wrote a script for that. And it's called migrate virtual machine. And it's very simple, it does this. Migrate a VM from here to over there, just from one cluster to another. It has some options here to use. You can either specify the instance name, those are the things that I listed before, or you could just use your name. So my VM is called Tiny, so you can just migrate that one. It will refuse if it's not unique. So in CloudSec, you can have different tenants can use the same name of a VM. So if there's another Tiny VM, then it says, I don't know which one you mean, so you have to specify. Let's have a look. How does it work? So this is the script, migrate virtual machine. And then you tell it, this VM Tiny of mine I want to migrate it to this cluster. That's all. And there's the output. And one important thing to note is that it will run dry run mode by default. All these scripts, you can just run. It will do nothing. It will only tell you, hey, this is what I would have done. So you can just verify if it will run OK. And then you need to pass something extra to have it actually run. I'm going to demo this in a moment. So it would send an email, would have stopped stuff, et cetera. So if you pass the exec flag, then it would really start migrating stuff. So our customer team said, you know, we agreed on this time window to do the migrations, but then they wanted to know exactly from which moment that the VM wouldn't be there. And then we said, you know, we have to do 1,000 migrations. How are we going to keep track of this kind of thing? And it wouldn't really make sense, so we thought of automating it. And then in the end, we just came up with a very simple solution. We'll just send emails. So we're sending the customer team an email in we start. So we're going to start migrating your VM. It's going down now. And then we go through this procedure, which does exactly what I said before, just migrate the disks and then start it up again. And we'll send an email when we're done. So everybody was very happy. And since this was a script, it was also something with a good gift to the teams themselves, and they could help migrating the stuff. There were two things going on there. If you have a snapshot, it will check if the snapshot was OK, and it will not proceed if it's not OK, because if the snapshot failed, you don't want to migrate, because if something goes wrong, there's no way to go back. But we did notice that if you have a snapshot schedule, which means every day at 1 a.m., make a snapshot, then if you migrate it to a new storage, that schedule is lost, which is a bug. I filed it. I need to fix it, send a patch. But since I didn't have the time to do it, we worked around it by making the script read the snapshot schedule and then put it back again. So this is migrating stuff in a very reliable way, because everything that's there will be there again. So this is a very nice way to migrate stuff. But it's only one. The script only migrates one VM. And why did we do that? Because we want to have flexibility. And here, we're going to combine two of the things that I told you. So remember the list virtual machine script, right? You could just list all kind of VMs. And then we have the migrate script. So if we combine this stuff and use some grep and awk and things like that, the result from the listing, we could generate the migrate virtual machine command. So this is the result. So this list virtual machines has this result, the list that I showed you before. And now we're rewriting it to these commands. And this is how we could automate migrations, because then we have a very flexible way to select, and we would just pipe it through migrate, and it would send emails and update everybody, and it would just be a way that could run overnight if you wanted to do. So this is how we migrated off all the VMs. But there's more running on the CloudSec cluster, because you also have the system VMs, and more particularly the router VMs. So the second challenge was to migrate this stuff. Everybody ever tried doing that? Because it doesn't work. You can only do that between hosts from the same cluster. So it didn't really make sense, you know? You have this Nexenta cluster with 6 hosts, and you could migrate live between them, which is kind of fun and very easy for maintenance, but you cannot do that. So I again thought it must be a UI bug. But then, really, you know, there was no way to do it. It just wasn't supported. I don't know why, because it's you know, you want to remove clusters over time. You want to do the management of the life cycle. So more magic. Since we're good in automating, we just looked at how does this stuff work? How can we find a way around it? And then we looked at this again. We said, you know, this router VM has one disk, always just one disk. And this ID, router 1234, always has this disk, 1234. So then we used the same trick. You said, you know, if we can't migrate it like this, we're just going to migrate the disk to over there. And we'll just make sure that we'll move it that way. And that works. So concept is this. Router is running on a cluster or a pod that you want to get rid of. You do a migration. So this cannot be done live, because you have to shut it down and then migrate it to the other side. But since you can use the redundant router feature, you can do one at a time. And if you're using a VPC, there's now a feature to make that redundant as well. So that shouldn't be a problem, because you can just do one at a time. And how you make sure you do one at a time? By making the right selections in the listing. So you just limit it to only have the routers in one data center, for example, and then you can migrate to the other side. So here are the options to use. So that's the way to migrate VMs and router VMs. And before everything was empty, then we figured out there was still something left on the old storage. So imagine you have this, you have a VM that stopped but last run on that cluster. Or there are disks that were attached and then detached, so that do not belong to any disk anymore. So there was another script just to migrate everything that was already offline. And you can start with this. It's fairly easy. You could just run it. It has a mode where it can display stuff. So there are, we were here emptying the storage pool. So here you have the disks. And then it can just move them to the new location. And CloudSec will, this will be done using the CloudSec API. So CloudSec knows exactly where this disk is residing. So if you ever want to connect it, attach it again to EVM, this will work perfectly. So this is how we emptied the Nexenta pod. So this was now out of order. And what we did then was buy more NetApp storage here and just use the same hypervisors, reinstall them. We learned a thing or two about how to connect them and to do stuff. And then we built new stuff here so that we ended up with almost tripled the capacity that we had in the beginning. And we really needed that, because once the problem with Nexenta was solved, we built new NetApp storage, the growth of everything just exploded almost. So we really needed to accelerate the build there. But this was a way to get it completely automated out of the way. So that's awesome. And now that we are working on this CloudSec toolbox and to automate stuff, which worked really fine, we just wanted to have some other things to automate. Because if you operate CloudSec, and we do that at quite large scale, we have around 200 hypervisors running in CloudSec, then you really need to automate stuff, because otherwise it's just too much work. One of the cool things about CloudSec is that you can upgrade it. And it sounds like a basic feature, but the other stack thingy can do it, so that's cool. But if you want to upgrade, that usually means that you also need to upgrade a system VM template. And a system VM template is used to create routers. So you can get rid of them. And that might impact users, because the default script that comes with CloudSec that can reboot all the thing and then regenerate it needs to be a little bit smarter, because it will just reboot redundant things at the same time. At least there's a chance it can do it. So then we said, you know, we want to have finer control over it. And we wrote another script, just with the simple task, upgrade a router. And upgrading a router means shutting it down, replacing its template, providing the configuration again, and then starting. This process takes 2 or 3 minutes. So that's, I mean, it's still a VM. It should be a container. Then we can do a micro thingy in seconds. So we're looking into that, but now it's still a VM. But at least we could automate it. And then, again, connecting the dots, making selections. So here's another flag, only routers to be upgraded. So you can say, make a list of everything that needs to be upgraded. And then you can also limit it on a certain pod, like we do here. Say, you know, this pod. And do some bash magic and generate these commands again. And to give a more extra example, you can write log files, for example, if you wanted to do that, to see the output. And then our customer teams really liked the email approach. So they wanted to know exactly, you know, when are you doing stuff? When are you gonna break it down? So we implemented the email features as well. And even if you have redundant pairs, you still want to know when one was down and when it came back again, so that you can verify that if everything was working properly. And this way of working really rocked, because we could just have selections, then pipe it through some script, and then automate the hell out of it. Even cooler, you can do this stuff in parallel, because that saves a lot of time. And that, since it's bash, you can just, it's fairly easy. All you have to do is add this one, put it to the background, and then pipe it to SH, and if we come here. But there is some danger involved. Because if you're going to do this in parallel, it will just send all the API calls at once to CloudSec, and it's going to start rebooting stuff for you. It will do some scheduling, but you have no control over it again, because you almost tell CloudSec, do this as soon as possible. So if you do this within one pod, you'll probably be fine. But if you do this with multiple pods in the zone, for example, your redundant pairs might be hit at the same time, and you'll be in problem. So take care about this sequential stuff, because it might get ugly. So if you know what you're doing, this is going to be fine. So to give you an example, we have physical environments, and we have these cloud environments now. And we connect them using bridges. So there's this software-defined networking thing. So we have a layer 2 bridge between them. So VMs in one environment can talk to VMs in another environment. And it's totally transparent. VMs don't know which is in the cloud or which is in the old environment. These routers are not really routers, because it's layer 2. Nothing is ever routing there. So there's no inline traffic. So you can just reboot it, because those routers only provide DNS, DHCP, and stuff like that. So these routers are perfect to do in parallel, because, I mean, having your DHCP server gone for 2 minutes, who cares? You know, you can do them all together. Doesn't matter. They're all different networks. There's no redundancy there. So this is interesting. And we have around 30% of those routers. So if you do upgrades, you can just kick off the first 30% almost immediately, and then do the other one per pod. That speeds stuff up. So we use XenServer. At least that's where we started. But we want to have a multi-vendor approach, so we're working with KVM as well. But XenServer took the most of our time to automate stuff. So why is that? We wrote a script for it, and you can see here that we have clusters of 6 in XenServer. We figured out this is a nice number. XenServer has this concept of a pool master. So one of them is the boss. So most communication will be done there, and it will just dispatch it to the other ones. This concept is exactly the problem and my worry with this whole system, because if this one dies, another one will pop up, but it feels a bit different. So we had to automate the hell out of it to make it work. So because what did we want to achieve? We wanted to have a cluster, and we do N+1 redundancy. So one of them, the capacity of one of them can be lost, and then still everything can run over there. So if you need to patch XenServer, and the last year we had some serious patches, of course, we just want to do a rolling upgrade. So we would empty one of the hypervisors, like this one, and then live migrate everything to the others, then patch it, bring it back in the pool, and do repeat it again. So this script can help doing that. So you start like this, and you put it to maintenance, and then you see that those 10 VMs are now somewhere within the others. And there's an interesting thing with the Xen tools going on. So XenServer need tools in order to work. Not entirely true. It does for Windows, it needs it for the drivers, and it also has some magic going on where it knows how to migrate. So if your VM does not have the Xen tools, XAPI, which is running on XenServer, doesn't want to migrate because it says, I have no tools. But it doesn't make sense. Why wouldn't you be able to migrate it? So then we Googled that, and we were looking for solutions. And then we figured out that if you could just fake the version, because XAPI has this database of Xen tools, you could just say, hey, you have that version, without ever having any tools installed. And then it would try to migrate it, say, hey, I have tools, so I should be able to migrate, but I can't talk to it. So I'll just copy all memory instead of going into the tools and seeing, oh, you're using 50% of the memory, so I'll copy only that. So it was a little inefficient, but hey, who cares? Our goal was to have it automated and make sure everything works. So this way, you can just have rolling pool upgrades of XenServer and automate the patching. We do it cluster by cluster. And no VM will ever go down, because we have this overcapacity. So if this one is down, it has no VMs. So there's enough capacity there just to keep everything running. So this really saved a lot of time, especially if you have more clusters, then this automated way of working really rocks. Something else that really comes along with running clouds is that, I mean, IP addresses change, so people use IP addresses at different times. And so you need to know if somebody is at your desk saying, hey, you know, who's using this IP address, because something goes wrong, I don't know, it got hacked or crazy traffic patterns, etc. We wanted to have an easy way to figure out who's using that IP address. So we wrote a script for that as well. So for example, this IP address is used by this router, and you have some more specifics over there to connect. It also works with internal IP addresses, but those don't have to be unique, because the 10.1.1 thing, I mean, everybody could use it. And in fact, in our employee cloud, if I run this in our employee cloud, I get maybe 100 results, because it's a default, everybody uses the same. But then still, based on other information, you could figure it out. And most questions are asked about the public IP addresses, because that's where the traffic goes upstream. So this is a very easy way. Just have somebody at your desk and type it. And then, since we didn't really like that as well, we just learned them, you know, if you look there, you can run the script and have fun. So that saves a lot of time. Well, you can buy the best hardware. You can do the best software thing and configure it all properly. But then, you know, if you have enough hypervisors, it will still sometimes crash. Some it might be hardware. It might be something. So since we have a couple of hundred of those, sometimes one will go off. We also have scripts for that, just to automate it away. When an outage appears, CloudSec makes HA workers, which means that that it will start investigating what's going on. Because if it misses a hypervisor, then it knows what's running over there, and it will figure out, you know, this was supposed to be running, but it's not running anymore. So we made a nice overview. So imagine this hypervisor crashed. Then this is a simplified overview. And you can see that this VM called desktop, that was supposed to be running, is in state stopped. So that's not good. And there's a scheduled investigator to have it running again. So this friend here, VM123, is actually running already. So the HA worker is done. So what you see is that once a hypervisor crashes, CloudSec will immediately kick in and start spinning up VMs on other hypervisors. That's also why we have the redundancy. We don't use 100% capacity. So if one fails, you can still have room to spin them up again. You don't have to wait for the hypervisor to be back. And this has a very nice overview to see how far am I recovering already. What we also do is this list of VMs, we send it as soon as possible to an internal list saying, you know, this hypervisor crashed, this was impacted, so everybody knows what's going on. And you don't have to look in CloudStack for where do we have to find this information, because it might change already, because this hypervisor is down, so it has no running VMs anymore. So in CloudSec, you cannot see which VM was supposed to be running there before. And using this script directly from the database, the HA workers, you can use it. So that really makes operations a lot easier. Another thing that we want to know is what's CloudSec doing at certain times. So you can read log files, and you can find all kind of stuff, but it has this concept of running jobs, asynchronous jobs. So we wrote a script that could overview what's going on. So for example, it's taking snapshots here. It's starting a VM and it's stopping a VM. So this gives an impression of what's going on. What doesn't fit in right here, but if you run the script, it will also display the job ID and the parent job ID. So you can figure out which one belongs to each other. And if there's a tree of them and everything waits for everything, then you know something's wrong and you might want to kick one of those jobs. But at least you know now that it's creating snapshots. And for example, if you want to shut down the CloudSec incident, in send server's case, it might be wise to wait before the snapshots are gone, because there's a communication thing going on that doesn't work properly. Another bug, we need to fix it, because it doesn't work properly now. But so at least you know what's going on and what's waiting for. And if you see a lot of results over there, you either have a very busy cloud or something else goes wrong. Then we have auditors. And so this is important for our company, because we have a lot of certifications and stuff like that. But the thing is that we are a kind of different company, because everybody in our, we have 150 engineers, and they all have access to everything. And that freaks out auditors. They just don't get it, why you would want to do that. So we try to explain, and we try to work around that. And it's not that literally everybody has access at a certain time, but everybody can create access for himself if you wanted to do. And if I don't know anything about a certain customer, I'm not going to create an account there, because what should I be doing? But it's there's a kind of freedom, because everybody should be able to jump in and help this out. This way, and the thing to add is that we really hire highly skilled people, so we can do that. We can trust each other, and that works fairly well. So we talked with auditors, and they understand the idea, and they understand why we are doing it. And then we, in the end, agreed on creating a report and saying, you know, at least it should be visible who's owning the stuff, who's accessing. So we created another script and say, you know, let's report what accounts are there. So for example, this is my private employee account, which could be a tenant. And I'm now the only one having an admin account. So it makes sense, right? But if this would be a tenant, multiple people would go here. And at least you would be able to see. So if a certain tenant, I add an account, that will be visible. So we have mailing lists that go to everybody. And we'll send this report automatically every month, saying, hey, Remy created an account there. Oh, he has an account right there. And if the other people think that doesn't make sense, then, you know, you start talking about it and say, well, what are you doing there? So get rid of it. And this is a kind of natural way of having the access list going properly. And auditors really like if we at least report it like that. So might be able to use it in another area as well. And all this information comes from CloudSec directly, so you can just use it to in other ways as well. It's just running the script. And here you say the difference between the display type, either screen or this email thing. So if you do screen, it will just put it on screen and email nothing. So this is the collection of CloudSec op scripts. You can clone the repository at Schubach-Phillips repository. Everything is there. There are even more scripts that I didn't touch yet that are either more specific things going on. So just check it out. It's fairly easy. And what I wanted to tell you right now is how to get started with this thing, because there are some guidelines that are easy to do. So you could just git clone it. I mean, everybody probably did that. That shouldn't be the problem. And then there's this configuration file. I provided a sample, so you can just copy it. If you have a look at this configuration file, then I showed you all kind of things. So we do stuff with email, and we do stuff with CloudSec. So the email stuff, you need to configure who's the mail from and who's the what's the SMTP server. So by default, if you're running on a Linux system, you can just use localhost. And this is probably a department thing or a group or whatever, or your personal thing. Everybody can configure their own email address. So the email to is retrieved from CloudSec. So if you specify a tenant, then CloudSec already knows the email address. It will use that, of course. But this is where you get the email from. The organization, that's the name at the bottom of the email saying, hey, regards, this organization, you can configure it. More interestingly is the API configuration. So if you want to talk to CloudSec, you need API credentials. And since we are using a multi-tenant environment, you have two options. You can either say, you know, I'll just specify it in this file. I'll just paste them in and use that, and don't worry about it. But you can also use a different approach. Did anybody hear about a tool called CloudMonkey? You probably did. So the CloudMonkey thing is, it's a nice tool that can query the API. You can type API commands, and it will just respond very quickly. But the thing is that it doesn't allow you to like joining in SQL language. So that's why scripts are handy. But the cool thing about CloudMonkey is that it has profile support. So you can put in different profiles for different tenants, and then do all kind of queries and say, hey, I want to use this profile. How do you want to do that profile? So for different tenants, you can have different profiles. And these profiles look almost like this. They have API keys and secret keys and a URL. So these scripts can use the CloudMonkey configuration. Because everybody in our team was already using CloudMonkey, it didn't make sense to rewrite all kind of stuff to have this profile thing in this configuration file as well. There's provided here one way to use it, but you can totally omit it if you're using CloudMonkey. On the command line, you can specify dash dash config profile and then specify the name of a CloudMonkey profile. It will just look up the file, look up the section, and then use that instead of those API keys. So that makes it very flexible to use the scripts. Final, some of the scripts use the SQL database directly. For example, the HA workers that I showed you, when a hypervisor crashes, you need to specify a password here, or you can specify it on the command line. But on the command line, it's this bad thing of ending up in your history, so you probably don't want to do that, so you can just specify it in the script layer. Then there are some dependencies, just three things you need to install. The Marvin library is provided, which one I took over there, and you should be ready to rock and to have the scripts running. So these slides will be on Twitter, so you can just copy-paste some of the bash stuff. I guess if I got the time zone thingy right, the tweet might be flying by anytime soon, so that we'll see if that works. Of course, it's on GitHub, so feel free to fork it to make suggestions, send pull requests, and make stuff better. And feel free to contact me anytime to discuss things, maybe requirements or other things. Maybe say it helped. I would also really like to know that, so that's interesting. Are there any questions about that are popping up, things that you say?
You did mention CloudMonkey as a dependency. Is this not new?
No, CloudMonkey is not a dependency. All I do with CloudMonkey is using its configuration. So I'm literally only reading the configuration file and parsing it in Python, and then use it over there. We're using Marvin to talk to the CloudSig API, not with CloudMonkey. So you don't need it. It's just an option for people that use it already, that you could say, hey, since you have configured this already, it makes sense not to do it twice. Any other things? Make sense? Cool. Thanks, guys.